From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And we begin today with Illinois U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth. The Democrat from Hoffman Estates is in her second term. She's a member of the Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee and chairs the Subcommittee on Aviation Safety, Operations, and Innovation. That has put her at the center of the congressional response to a series of problems with aircraft made by the company Boeing, which until 2 years ago had its headquarters in Chicago. Those problems include two crashes that killed hundreds of people in 2018 and 2019, and an incident this month in which a panel blew out in midair, leaving terrified passengers flying with a hole in the side of an Alaska Airlines plane. That is among the many issues I spoke with Duckworth about when we talked yesterday, Tuesday afternoon, a time chosen to accommodate her schedule. Senator Duckworth, welcome back to the 21st Show. I want to ask you, as chair of the Senate Aviation Subcommittee, you've been vocal about safety issues at Boeing. After your recent meeting with the CEO, what are your main concerns regarding the safety of Boeing's aircraft?
Well, I see, you know, my main concern is that they are trying to turn around an organization that has some serious safety culture and also a culture of quality control issues. You know, the new CEO reassures me that he's trying to change that culture. And yet, you know, they did submit a letter to FAA asking for an exemption to a safety exemption so they could put an aircraft into commercial service, the 737 MAX 7, with a known engine anti-ice fault. And so we had an extensive conversation with that. And I'm pleased to say that he reversed that decision earlier today in terms of requesting an exemption from FAA. But this is, you know, this is part of the issue. Boeing is a storied American company, and I want them to continue to be a leader in the world. And they can't do that if they are unable to meet, you know, the safety standards that we expect of them.
Yeah, you said mentioned today, I'll just tell listeners we are taping this on Tuesday afternoon. What would have been the risk to passengers if that system had failed?
Well, it would have created broken pieces of the engine that would have been sucked into the engine. It could have caused an engine failure. And in the worst case scenario, when that engine ingested those broken pieces, it could have created shrapnel that could penetrate the aircraft cabin. I don't know if you remember the Southwest airline flight a few years ago where an engine failed and basically shrapnel was created when that engine failed from inside, from parts of the engine, and it actually penetrated the window, and a woman was sucked out partway and died of blunt force trauma. So that's the exact kind of thing that could have happened here.
You mentioned some of the safety culture issues at Boeing. What is your hypothesis about why one of America's premier design and manufacturing companies at one time has had so much trouble in more recent times?
I think it's been two things happening. I think that because Boeing had such a sterling reputation, the FAA trusted them too much and allowed them to do this program where they, at a time when the FAA was finding its staffing being cut and having to do inspections and certification inspections of new aircraft, allowed Boeing to self-certify. Now, this is something that's standard practice, but usually the FAA provides significant oversight. And unfortunately, with the cuts at the FAA in the past decade or so, you know, they allowed Boeing to get away with a lot more, and Boeing took advantage of FAA not having a strong an oversight, and they self-certified themselves on, for example, the MAX 8 systems that they say were safe and did not tell pilots about, which led to those two incredibly deadly crashes with hundreds of passengers dying. And there were other issues as well with that particular aircraft. And so now we find ourselves in a place where Boeing has to reverse this culture of trying to push out as many aircraft off their production line to meet the demand as quickly as possible. At a certain point, you know, they have to put the safety of the flying public over the profits for the corporation. And that should be the standard position. But I think they got into a place where they were more worried about corporate profits than they were the safety of the flying public. And that resulted in some pretty deadly incidents, as well as some very troubling ones that like the door plug issue that just happened with Alaska Airlines.
Would you feel safe flying on a Boeing aircraft home to Illinois?
I do. Yeah, I do every week. I fly in a Boeing aircraft going back and forth between Chicago and D.C. I fly in on the MAX 8 most often. I will tell you, though, that is in part, I feel comfortable in part because of Boeing, but mostly because the FAA has stepped up and is doing its job regulatorily in terms of having a new FAA administrator. We just confirmed one, and Administrator Whitaker has shown that he is going to uphold the highest standards. And you can see that in his recent grounding of all the MAX 9s, which I wonder if previous administrators would have been as quick to do so.
I know you've also been aware of the number of, what would you say, close calls, near hits, I guess you might describe them, among aircraft on the ground, in the air. I think it was the New York Times had a big investigation of this. You had a hearing on this in the Aviation Subcommittee. What does the Congress need to do? What does the federal government need to do to make sure that, I mean, it seems like there are a lot of disasters that were just very narrowly averted in recent years.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And I actually use the word crisis. We're in a safety crisis. There's a couple of things that we need to do, and we're going to do them hopefully by next week. And that is we are about to pass a new FAA reauthorization bill, which will provide more funding. Actually, we're going to triple the funding for the training of air traffic controllers. One of the major causes leading to this is we don't have enough air traffic controllers in this country, and they are working in under extreme fatigue. I'll give you an example in the Chicagoland area. Chicago Center, sometimes need to have 10 air traffic controllers, but only have five on duty, or you have air traffic controllers who've been working day after day for weeks at a time and are exhausted. They have minimum rest requirements, and they're meeting those minimum rest requirements, but just that, and they need more rest than that. And so by tripling the funding to grow that workforce of air traffic controllers, we're gonna help alleviate that issue. Another issue is we need to have ground radar on the ground at all of our airports. We had an incident in Texas recently where a cargo aircraft almost ran into a commercial jet aircraft, but the pilot in the cargo aircraft, who'd been cleared to land by air traffic control during very foggy conditions at an airport that did not have radar on the ground, a cargo aircraft pilot managed to spot the other aircraft and avoid the collision with just 100 feet to spare. And so we need to have ground radar at all of our airports, not just the radars that look at the airplanes in the sky, but radars that watch airplanes on the ground, so that when there's fog and those conditions, when the air traffic controller, the ground controller who watches airplanes on the ground, they can see where all those aircraft are. And we also tripled the funding for pilot training as well in this new FAA bill that we'll be working on next week.
You know, you mentioned the rest requirements. I was really struck by that aspect of the stories that I read about this, because I think it's, if you work a 10-hour shift, you have to have 9 hours off, and then you go back to controlling aircraft in the sky. And I was thinking of the metaphor, oh, would you want your surgeon operating on you with that little sleep? But I guess I don't even need a metaphor, right? Because do you really want your skies to be controlled by somebody operating on that little rest? Do those requirements need to be reviewed?
I'm open to reviewing them right now. I think if we could just get more air traffic controllers on the job. And by the way, these are good jobs with good pay, and there's people who want to do them. And we need to train them. We have more people who want to become air traffic controllers than we have training slots. And so by tripling the funding for it, we'll be able to get more air traffic controllers through so that we won't have to rely on the same air traffic controllers, so that it's more than a 10-hour rest, so that they can actually have a couple of days off here and there. Yes, I'm more than happy to look at the rest requirements. But if you only have a small number of air traffic controllers, all you're doing is just forcing them to work more days back to back. The solution is to put more air traffic controllers on the job.
This is the 21st show. We're speaking with Illinois U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth. I want to now turn to ask you about the recent attack on American servicemen and servicewomen in Jordan. Three were killed, more than 40 others were injured, and you, of course, know more about what lies ahead for them than most of us can imagine. How should this incident shape our military strategy and presence in the Middle East, particularly concerning these Iranian government-backed militias?
Well, we certainly need to make sure that we respond to the attack in a very precise way, going after those militias. I wouldn't want our response to be one that could result in an escalation, because nobody wants another war in the Middle East. But I do think we have to go after these terrorists and make it clear that this is not something that you're going to get away with. And I don't think most people even knew that we had American troops in Jordan.
I did because
on Saturday I just went to a deployment ceremony for the Illinois National Guard, where we sent 250 troops into that area of operation. So this is something that the American people need to understand, that we have troops actively serving in Iraq. We have troops actively serving in Jordan and other places right now. And so we need to support them, but we also need to have a cohesive strategy as a nation for how we respond to these attacks, and especially go after terrorists without escalating to an all-out war. Because it wouldn't do our service members any good for us to escalate to a war with Iran, for example, that would then end up in us having to send more troops into the Middle East.
You know, you mentioned these theaters of operations where we have troops deployed now, and a lot of people aren't aware of it. What is the argument for that? Because there is a strain in American politics gaining popularity on the other side of the aisle, primarily, that says America should be pulling away from these adventures overseas, so to speak. How do you feel about that?
Well, it's just not something that we can do. I mean, part of what they're doing is safeguarding the economic viability of our nation, because so much shipping goes through the Red Sea, for example, and the Houthi rebels are attacking commercial shipping in the Red Sea. And so, you know, the corn and soybean that we grow in Illinois, and the pork that we send overseas, and the good American made products that we're sending to market in Europe can't get there. And so world trade, global trade is dependent on those trade routes. And so part of what our troops are doing is participating with international partners in safeguarding those shipping lanes. We absolutely have to go after the terrorists, and we are doing that. And I urge President Biden to retaliate against those terrorists who attacked our troops in Jordan. But pooling American troops out is not the solution either, because it would be a great negative economic effect on the United States and on the American people.
Speaking of America's involvement overseas, there was a time when at least some Republicans were willing to join with Democrats to support funding for the Ukrainians resisting Russia's invasion, which is going on 2 years ago now, depending on if you don't count Crimea, when it was going on nearly a decade ago. I want to ask you, has the time for that coalition passed?
No, there are still folks who are very verbally supportive of Ukraine on the Republican side, not the least of which is the Republican leader, Mitch McConnell. Yes, there are some isolationists on that side who I feel are very short-sighted, because, you know, if Russia were to successfully defeat Ukraine, then that puts them right on the doorstep of NATO. And remember that Illinois has been our Illinois National Guard, for example, has been working in partnership with the Polish military now for 35 years. And as part of the NATO Article 5 of the NATO Treaty, we are obligated to come to the defense of our NATO allies should they come under attack. So by supporting Ukrainians to fight off the Russians on their own, we're actually preventing us from having to send more U.S. troops into NATO. It's the right thing to do for NATO, but it's also the right thing to do for the United States as well. And, you know, many of my Republican colleagues understand that and continue to support Ukraine. I think it's much more the minority who unfortunately have a very loud voice on the other side that are pushing for this. And of course, those who support President Trump, former President Trump, who we all know was a great friend of Putin's and not someone that I would listen to for advice on what to do with Ukraine. But unfortunately, some of my colleagues on the Republican side are.
Well, and as you know, even if they are verbally supporting Ukraine, they have also said that something has to be done with the border. And it seems, you know, there are real questions about whether the Republicans will take yes for you know, whatever may come in terms of compromising on border security. Let me ask you briefly about that. How do you think the Biden administration has done with regard to the situation at the southern border, which, of course, as you know, is a much more salient issue now in Illinois, as tens of thousands of migrants have been bused to Chicago and elsewhere here.
Well, I think much more can be done at the border. And I've been down to the border and I've even crossed the border into Mexico. And I will tell you that there is a crisis there. And it's not just migrants from Latin America trying to make their way across. There are migrants from all over the world making their way through Brazil and into Latin America. I have been one to have always said that we need to more than double the number of Border Patrol agents. We need to tighten our border security. We have to have, you know, more security systems where it's appropriate. If it's physical barriers, and then that's fine. But I actually think more electronic barriers will allow us to cover more ground. I also think that for many of these migrants, have opening migrant processing centers in Mexico and other places in Latin America, so they never make it to the border, is also another solution to what's happening there. So they don't have to present themselves for parole at the border. They can present themselves in Mexico or Guatemala or somewhere else. And unfortunately, President Trump cut funding for those programs. And I think we need to expand those programs to keep those migrants in their home country so that they're not passing through, you know, a peaceful country just to get to the U.S. border. But I absolutely think that there's a crisis there and we must do better at the border, and not the least of which supporting our Border Patrol agents with all the equipment that they need. And certainly they need many more personnel to deal with the issue.
All right, we need to take a break. More with Illinois U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth when we return. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Let's get back to my conversation with Illinois U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth, recorded Tuesday afternoon in order to accommodate her schedule. You can always let us know what you think about what we've been talking about by emailing talk@21stshow.org. With the time we have remaining, I do want to ask you about some bigger picture democracy questions. There is obviously heightened awareness about the risks of political violence this year. We certainly saw that after the 2020 election. How do you view the short and long-term threats to American democracy, America's constitutional order in the coming year?
Well, you know, it's not the first time that our democracy has been tested, and democracy is hard, but I think it's worth fighting for. And that means, you know, when I was in uniform defending it, but here in Congress, it means continuing to engage and continuing to participate in the system. I don't think we can everybody go to their own camps and nobody talk to each other. It's why I continue to engage with my Republican colleagues and find ways to work together. And there are many more of us doing that than the loud voices that you hear. But yeah, we have some real challenges. And I think that we ultimately have to uphold the rule of law, and no one is above the law, whether that's a former president or a sitting U.S. senator. And we have to have trust in our judicial system. We have to have a real balance of power between the legislative branch and the executive branch so that we don't have, you know, authoritarian presidencies. But that only happens if we all engage and if Americans vote and participate fully in the system. And maybe I'm just too optimistic, but, you know, I still think that we're still the strongest democracy in the face of the earth. And, you know, we just have to keep working at it.
You use that word trust, and I think that is so key because, you know, political scientists who measure these things have found that trust is declining in so many spheres. Trust in institutions, trust in public officials, trust in the media, trust in each other. How do we rebuild that trust and unity in our society?
One interaction at a time. For me, is making sure that I am accessible to my constituents, and for me, getting out there and seeing folks and talking to folks and listening to my constituency, even when they have things to say to me that I may not agree with. Here in the Senate and with my colleagues in both the Senate and the House, it's continuing to engage with them, continuing to co-sponsor legislation and find ways to find common ground, and trying to find ways to compromise. And you know, this border security package, it's going to come, you know, we're going to hopefully get to an agreement on here soon. And it looks like we're going to. It's probably not going to make Democrats happy and fully happy. And it's, you know, we're probably going to be mad about a few things and we'll be happy about a few things. And so will the Republicans. But frankly, that's the nature of compromise. For me, it's just about continuing to engage and being willing to continue to work through the processes. instead of just retreating to our own camps.
Do you encounter many voters, you know, wearing the stereotypical red MAGA hat who challenge you on your positions?
Oh, I do. I get protested. I get folks who are extreme on the far right. I get folks who are extreme on the far left. But I talk to everyone and I engage with everyone. And I still do town halls. I still go to parades. I still visit schools and meet with groups. And I think it's really important, even when maybe I don't agree with groups, I welcome their input. I am their senator, whether or not they voted for me.
Yeah, and maybe that's a good place to end our conversation, because what do you say to that voter, especially downstate, right? For someone for whom President Trump remains very popular, that you represent them as well as, you know, the Democrats who overwhelmingly reelected you last time out.
So what I say to them is I believe that they love this country as much as I love this country, and that we're just looking at the issue, whatever that issue is, from slightly different perspectives. So, of course, we're going to have different solutions to that issue. And we have to find a way to listen to one another and understand the other side's perspective somewhat. And I'm always going to be willing to listen. But that I'm going to start from a place, when I engage with my constituents, of believing that they love this country as much as I do. And I was willing to die for her.
Senator Tammy Duckworth, thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me on.